You're listening to WPVM LP 103.7 Asheville, WPVMFM.org. It's the voice of Asheville heard around the world.
This is A Better World, coming to you from the studios of WPVM 103.7 FM in Asheville, North Carolina. And we're streaming live at WPVMFM.org. My name is McNair Ezard, and I'm your host for A Better World. Each week, we take an in-depth look at the people and organizations locally, nationally, and internationally who are working to create a world that works for everyone. And our guest today is Cecil Bothwell, an investigative reporter and biographer based in Asheville. He has received national awards from the Association of Alternative Newsweeklies and the Society of Professional Journalists for investigative reporting, criticism, and humorous commentary. He is a former news editor of Asheville City Paper, former managing editor of Asheville's Mountain Express, and founding editor of the Warren Wilson College environmental journal, Heartstone. He served for several years as a member of the National Editorial Board of the Association of Alternative Newsweeklies, and also served on the boards of two international educational nonprofit organizations working in Latin America. Cecil served two terms on the Asheville City Council. He is author of over 20 books, including The Prince of War, Billy Graham's Crusade for a Holy Christian Empire. His latest book is Regarding Charlie, published by Brave Ulysses Books. And Cecil will be speaking at Firestorm Books in West Asheville on Wednesday, September 2nd at 6 p.m. And he'll be talking about his book and about the life and work of Appalachian activist Charlie Thomas. Cecil, welcome to A Better World.
I'm glad to be here, McNair.
Pleasure having you. I appreciate you coming on the show. First of all, I want to thank you for writing this book. It covers a wide range of interesting historical events in the Asheville community, especially as those events relate to citizen activism, the city government, and developers. And in the first part of the book, you write about your initial introduction to Charlie Thomas. So tell us, who is Charlie Thomas?
Okay. What happened was I met Charlie in 2001. Just coincidentally, at a going away party for Claire Hanrahan, who had been convicted of crossing the line at the School of the Americas, which was a training operation by the U.S. Army, training soldiers for South America. And she crossed the line in a deliberate act of civil disobedience and was being sent to prison. So there was a going away party. And Ron Ogle, a local artist who I barely knew, buttonholed me at the party and said, you got to meet this guy, and took me over and introduced me to Charlie. And that began what has become a 25-year deep friendship. What I didn't know when I met him and learned gradually over time is his commitment to social justice and populist interests, causes. And when I was thinking about these last 25 years, a year ago or so, I was thinking about different events I'd witnessed, that I'd reported on, that I'd participated in, and I realized that the common thread was Charlie Thomas. He's an organizer. He's an organizer who wants absolutely no credit, which is why no one much knows him unless you were pretty close to him. He wasn't the kind of organizer who gets out in front of a band and runs the baton and shows off. He would organize and then get other people active, to get them to be active. So the book is in many ways about a lot of people in Asheville who have done amazing work. But the core was his organizing. I got to know his backstory. And so while I initially was working on this century, the 21st century, which is a boggling thing to me to think, you know, I grew up in the 20th century and now we're in this new one. I realized that reaching back into his life, where he came from, what was formative, how he happened to land in Asheville.
Well, speaking about formative, you write about his birth in one of the most impoverished counties in the country, Harlan County, Kentucky. Do you think his upbringing shaped kind of his outlook on what he's been called to do with his life?
I think very much so. He was the recipient or victim of what the coal companies were doing to coal country. The coal companies absolutely impoverished an entire region through their practices, something he wrote about in a magnificent book he published a year ago called Scrip, How the Coal Companies Impoverished Harlan County. What the coal companies did was they created a company store system. So their miners were paid in scrip, which was only spendable at the company store. And I think all of us have maybe heard a Tennessee Ernie Ford song about, I owe my soul to the company store. In one county, Harlan County alone, there were 100 different types of scrip. So that's how split up the county was. There were 100 different mines where the workers could only spend their income at that mine's store and for rent at that mine's housing. And you can imagine how that would prevent the growth of a normal economy. So he grew up there and was exposed to that in a poverty-stricken childhood. Most of his childhood, his mother was alone raising four children, but he managed to get out of there having really good grades and landed at Warren Wilson College here in Swannanoa, just east of Asheville, back when it was a two-year school, and got his associate degree there, working on the farm. For those who don't know Warren Wilson, part of Warren Wilson's curriculum is to work. Back then, they were actually building the buildings of the school. It had started as a farm school, a high school for rural youth who had no other opportunity for education, and became a junior college and then subsequently a four-year college. And then his experience there was formative. A particular incident that I report on there, a young woman he knew in the school was dating a black man, likely not at the school at the time. And when the dean found out about that, the dean had a convocation of all of the students and announced that since interracial marriage was illegal in North Carolina at the time, therefore interracial dating was not to be permitted at Warren Wilson College. And she got together with some others to form a protest. Charlie joined the protest, and that was part of his raised awareness about racial issues. She graduated a year ahead of him, but she gave him a phone call when he graduated and said, hey, I'm going to Mississippi to register voters. How would you like to go? And so she jumped a bus from Indiana, I think, down here, and they went on to Mississippi. This was the summer after the three young men were killed registering voters in Mississippi. So he was part of Freedom Summer in Mississippi, again, raising his awareness about social justice issues.
So his life of activism started pretty young. Do you think his introduction, because I read about this in your book, his introduction to the penal system was a result of his life's direction in activism, or did that kind of help also get him started in activism?
I bet it was a little of both. Certainly, the reason he ended up in federal prison was because of a raised awareness about the war in Vietnam. He was not going to participate. And when the draft board called him, he said, no, thanks. And he was sentenced to 3 years in federal prison for refusing the draft. So he'd already had his awareness, certainly about war, and before that about racism, raised. But then to get out of prison, he could get out after 2 years on good behavior. And he had good behavior. He was the prison librarian. they learned he could type. And so he was put in the library. One of the rules was you had to have a job. And one of his other protesters in prison with him had a wife in Boston who found him a job in Boston. So he went from Kentucky prison to Boston. And part of the job ended up being at the New England Free Press, which was an alternative newspaper in New England. At the time, anti-war, anti-racist, pro-woman, women's rights. And the first big job he worked on there was Our Bodies, Ourselves, which became a handbook for women globally, teaching women much of the medical information that doctors, male doctors, never bothered to tell them or didn't even know. I mean, that, you know, men don't always know what women need. So he was part of that, which became a multi-million seller around the world eventually. But that got him into printing, which became his career job. But also he was working for an activist newspaper, which furthered his consciousness raising. Back then, the Berrigan brothers, Daniel and Philip Berrigan, were two Catholic priests who were anti-war. And they expressed their activism by raiding draft boards and destroying the records in draft boards. Back then, everything was on paper. It wasn't an electronic system in the this around 1968 to 1970s, early 70s. So if records were destroyed at a local draft board, the odds of a young man being sent to Vietnam were reduced, at least. And Charlie even took part with Philip Berrigan's group in Boston, raiding a draft board one night, multiple draft boards one night. So again, consciousness raising, raising consciousness about direct action and how it can have an effect.
You also write that you couldn't have imagined that your introduction to Charlie would eventually alter your life journey. Can you speak to how that happened, how he helped alter your life journey?
I certainly can. One of the things about being an organizer is to be a font of ideas. And in 2002, and I think it was March of 2002, there was a short article, two paragraphs in the Asheville Citizen Times, about some of the Nixon tapes. Richard Nixon recorded lots of conversations in the White House. In fact, those tapes were part of the reason he ended up leaving office, when it became evident that from the tapes that he had helped organize the break-in at the Watergate by his so-called plumbers. Well, the piece that was released in 2002 showed that Billy Graham had been recorded in the White House. And what the recording showed was that Billy Graham was telling Nixon that Jews were responsible for a lot of the bad press in the country. They were responsible for all of the pornography being published in the country. And he said, maybe we can do something about them after you're reelected. That's a pretty amazing thing to say. Doing something about Jews does not have a good Christian history globally. Mm-hmm. And Charlie is the one who spotted the article, and he showed it to me. He said, you know, there's a book in that. I said, yeah. Well, there was a book in that that got me started. And I dug into Billy Graham's history. I read everything he wrote, and I read every reference I could find with the presidents, both the books by the presidents, books about the presidents, going back to Harry Truman. And we'd always been told that Graham was a spiritual advisor to the presidents. Well, what became clear as I read through all this stuff was that from Truman forward, Billy Graham advocated for war. He urged Truman into Indochina, as he did with Eisenhower, into French Indochina, Vietnam. He backed off a little under President Kennedy because Kennedy was a Catholic, And Billy Graham worked with Norman Vincent Peale, who was a famous author about power of positive thinking. Well, they worked from Switzerland to undermine Kennedy. They were responsible for all the talk that Kennedy would be loyal to the Vatican and not a good American. They tried to squash the Kennedy campaign because he was a Catholic, which in retrospect is kind of, there's a funny element that, leaping forward, 6 of 9 Supreme Court justices right now are Catholic. That's just an interesting historical note. So then under Lyndon Johnson, he particularly advocated for the war in Vietnam. In fact, Lyndon Johnson's bombing campaign of North Vietnam was called Rolling Thunder. That was named for Billy Graham's theme song for his events, Rolling Thunder of the Lord. Again, with Nixon, he advocated for the war in Vietnam. He didn't do as well with Carter. Carter was from a different branch of the Baptist Church. Graham was more of the talking about belief, and Carter was more about doing, as we saw after his term when he went with Habitat for Humanity, building homes and also enforcing, you know, helping with health in Africa. Again, with George H.W. Bush, and even with Clinton, he advocated for the U.S. Army to go into places. His whole idea was that the U.S. Army would Christianize the world, which is why the subtitle in my book about him, The Prince of War, the subtitle is Billy Graham's Crusade for a Holy, W-H-O-L-L-Y, Christian Empire. Mm-hmm. And he even stood beside George W. Bush at the National Cathedral when George Bush declared war on Iraq from a pulpit. Hence, that was the story that unfolded for me. It wasn't, my book is not a religious book about Graham. It's a political book about Graham.
If you just joined us, you're listening to a conversation with Cecil Bothwell, an investigative reporter and biographer based in Asheville. And his latest book is Regarding Charlie. Cecil will be speaking at Firestorm Books in West Asheville on Wednesday, September 2nd at 6 p.m. And you're listening to us on A Better World at 103.7 WPVM, and we're streaming live at WPVMFM.org. We can be the super shoppers. We can say we're really smart. We can say our town is doing fine. Okay, that's Dar Williams singing Bought and Sold from the album End of the Summer. So, Charlie, in addition to writing the book regarding Charlie and talking about his work in the community, are there other reasons that you wrote it? What are your hopes for what you want to accomplish with the book?
What I hope to accomplish with the book is showing how an individual can make tremendous change in the community simply by spotting a problem, thinking of what might be an answer, and then getting other people to join in to do that. That's what Charlie did when he landed in Asheville. For instance, when he and his wife Laura arrived here in the late 90s, 99, I guess, the employees at the French Broad Food Co-op were talking about unionizing the co-op. And he had, one of the spots we've skipped over here is that in between the earlier work and when he arrived here, he became a union organizer and had organized knitting mills and furniture factories as a hired organizer for the AFL-CIO. And he heard about that, and he realized that the workers at the French Broad Food Co-op didn't really know how to unionize, so he stepped in immediately right after they moved here and helped them unionize the French Broad Food Co-op. A little time passed, and in 2001, the Grove Park Inn had cooked up a deal with the city council to buy land which faces the city and county buildings downtown. Pack Square Park is what's there now. They were going to sell parkland to the Grove Park Inn for a high-rise condominium operation there and commercial storefronts. Very quietly cooked it up, but three people, Julie Brandt, Barry Summers, and David Lynch, had gotten together to try to stop it. And there was a thing called the Pack Square Conservancy, which was the official nonprofit that was redesigning the park. And expensively, boy, they spent a ton of money. But this group called themselves People Advocating Real Conservancy, PARC, P-A-R-C. Early on, Charlie joined with them and helped them organize a boycott of the Grove Park Inn, running full-page newspaper ads with all kinds of signatories to petitions and getting protesters to stand along the road leading to the Grove Park Inn when the Republican the Republicans were having one of their big confabs of the Grove Park Inn, and so it was lined with protest signs about the Grove Park Inn. That ended up in a public hearing, which I report on, and the people may have forgotten, that was attended by hundreds of people. It was a standing room only at the Renaissance Hotel conference room. It ended up erupting in shouts and counter shouts. And finally, Nelda Holder, who was the president of the local League of Women Voters, had to end the meeting. It was so contentious. And about 2 weeks later, Grove Park Inn announced they weren't going to build the building. So that's the kind of thing where he would step in and help. And he became the guiding light of PARC, really. A lot because he was a printer. He would print the posters. He would print the T-shirts. He would print the handbills. And so one issue after another would come up over the course of time. And PARC was active in all of them. For instance, the Asheville Global Report was a local newspaper here that had national reach. He helped get the Asheville Global Report distributed here. When I came up with the idea for the Rolling Thunder Down Home Democracy Tour, which was organized by Jim Hightower nationally, Charlie helped me organize that and make it happen here, where we had something over 50 local nonprofits participated in that at the Civic Center. Mountain Moral Monday was modeled on the Moral Monday campaign by Reverend Barber that was happening in Raleigh. PARC was the principal organizer of the Moral Monday, Mountain Moral Monday, which was the largest protest in Asheville up until the No Kings rally, the two of them this last year. 10,000 people showed up. Mm-hmm. PARC was the principal financial backer of Save the Magnolia when the county tried to sell the other side of the park to a developer to build condos more or less in front of the city hall. One thing, the Save Our Slopes campaign was emanated from PARC. You still see those little square stickers on cars all over town, raising awareness about the demolition of the slopes that was going on by developers. So one way and another, over the next 20 years or so, PARC was either the organizer or a strong participant in issue after issue in Asheville. And not all successful, but many of them successful.
The book kind of, and these are my words, not yours, but it kind of gives us a look at local government and its love affair with developers over the years. Asheville City Government, specifically the City Council, it seems they've had a long and close relationship with development over the years, as probably most communities have in the country. And I'm not sure if this is a good question or not, but is it possible for you to speak to kind of the overall progression of the relationships between the City Council and the waxing and waning of like conservative development and progressive decisions that they've made?
Yeah, for sure. And again, this is something I do go into, at least in part, in the book. All city councils, of course, have connection to commercial development. I mean, that's part of what councils always deal with. And it's a positive in many regards. And they shape development in many ways. But they also permit development. And therefore, it's a place where people with strong financial interests want to exert their influence. And partly because developers have frequent interaction with city staff, there's a very friendly relationship. And that's normal. That's not insidious. That's normal. If you see people a lot and have coffee with them and talking about a plan you have, you're friendly and you're nice to each other. And so rules, I think we've discovered perhaps in the current administration in Washington that a lot of law is willingness to obey the law. And a lot of development law at a city level involves interpretation. And how you interpret things depends on your worldview, and your worldview depends on who you talk to a lot. For instance, a very specific example, when Staples built their store on Merriman Avenue, just north of I-240, there was a rule about the total square feet of a sign on Merriman Avenue, and also a rule about the height of a sign on a business. The idea was to keep things toned down. That's what the sign ordinance was about, and to keep the playing field equal so that all stores had to obey the same rules about the size and about the height from the street. Well, the current planning director at the time, Scott Shuford, allowed Staples to measure the square feet of the letters in the sign. Staples' logo is white letters on a red background. So he called the 125 square foot limit was on the square feet of the letters, not the red background. But the law specifically says that the sign includes anything that's a logo for a business. So the signs were 600 square feet, counting the whole red background, which was more than four times as big as it was allowed. But his interpretation was that it was the letters. And that was one of the battles that Park only won partly. Through a public awareness campaign, Staples was forced to reduce the size of the signs. They had to take off the old ones and put a slightly smaller, but they still are not compliant today, nor are they compliant with the height. So that was the kind of, and so during the 8 years I was on council, I saw it over and over again, the fudging toward commercial interests. Mm-hmm. Another one is Ingles grocery store, big grocery chain based originally in Asheville. Every time they came to us with a sign request, they wanted more square feet of sign than they were allowed. There's a limit on commercial signage. And they would want not only the sign out at the highway or the road, but the signs on the building to be bigger than they were supposed to be, especially the ones on the building. And then they wanted to add, when they had Starbucks located inside, they wanted to add that, and they wanted to add the thing about the deli counter. And it was sort of like, I lost that battle as a voting member of council, and Park didn't succeed with them either. But the inclination of council was always to go with this big local employer. You know, it's as if, to me, it was as if, you see the sign out at the road that says Ingles, and somehow you're not going to be able to find the grocery at the other end of the parking lot. I mean, I wonder what that building is over there.
You know, it's interesting. And excuse me, in 1931, the philosopher John Dewey said that politics is the shadow cast on society by big business. And that government in general is an echo, and at times a direct accomplice of the interests of big business. And it kind of sounds like what you're talking about with regards to city councils in general, that this is not too far off base, yeah, what he said.
And Asheville has a history of it, as I'm sure all cities do, which I retell a little bit of in the book. Going back to its founding, the early city council was run by local people, including the Van Winkle, who was a lawyer who started the Van Winkle Law Firm. And he was on the board of, I think it was called a board of commission. I don't know. It wasn't, it became the city council over years. And big money ran the city into the ground around the time of the Depression for a couple of different reasons. But the city had all its money in a bank in Asheville that went under because it had made unsustainable loans to a lot of rich people who built houses up on Beaver Lake. And when the Depression hit and the bank went under, Asheville became bankrupt as a city. One of the officials committed suicide over it. Subsequent to that, there was no longer an elected mayor. I think no one wanted to be elected mayor for 40 years, until 1978 or 79 was the first elected mayor we had. Up until then, the councilors would tap somebody to be the mayor year by year, but nobody was actually holding the bag for all those years. Mm. They didn't want to be pasted with the corruption. The upside of all that is Asheville was too broke for the kind of urban renewal that other cities did during the 50s and 60s and even into the early 70s. And so we have more Art Deco buildings downtown than any other city except Miami. Other cities tore down all those old buildings because they built high-rise aluminum and steel monstrosities. But one of the reasons our downtown is so charming is that we went bankrupt and the city couldn't afford to do so much damage.
A positive aspect to going bankrupt, I would say. Yeah. If you just joined us, you're listening to a conversation with Cecil Bothwell, author of the new book, Regarding Charlie. And you're listening to us on A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. And we're streaming live at WPVMFM.org. And we'll be back with Cecil in just a few minutes after this break.
One tribe, one kind, one planet, one race. It's all one blood, don't care about your face, color of your eye or the tone of your skin. Don't care where you are, don't care where you been. Cause where we gonna go is where we wanna be. The place where the native language is unity, and the continent is called Pangea, and the main ideas are connected like a sphere. No propaganda to try to upper hand us, cause man, I'm loving this peace. Man, I'm loving this peace. Man, I'm loving this peace. I don't need no leader that's gonna force feed her. Concept to make me think I need her. Fear my brother and fear my sister and shoot my neighbor with my big missile. If I had an enemy, if I had an enemy, if I had an enemy, then my enemy's gonna try to come and kill me. Cause I'm his enemy. There's one tribe, y'all. We one tribe, y'all. We one tribe, y'all. We are one people. Let's catch amnesia. Forget about all that evil. Forget about all that evil. That evil that they feed you. Let's cast amnesia. Forget about all that evil. That evil that they feed you.
Okay, welcome back. That's Black Eyed Peas singing One Tribe from the album The End. And today on A Better World, we are talking to Cecil Bothwell. He's an investigative reporter and biographer based in Asheville. And he served two terms on the Asheville City Council. His latest book is Regarding Charlie, And Cecil will be speaking at Firestorm Books in West Asheville on Wednesday, September 2nd at 6 p.m. We were, before the break, we were talking about development and big business and the Asheville City Council, but I did want to point out a couple of more positive things, if I could, that are recently in the news. And one is in June of this year, Asheville leaders approved a one-year pause on the construction of new data centers until zoning laws are written to regulate them. I guess it's unknown at this point what the final outcome will be, but at least for now, this seems like a positive development. And then there's another example of where the current mayor, Esther Mannheimer, called for the termination of the city's contract with Flock Safety due to community concerns about privacy and surveillance. Are you aware of those two situations at all?
I'm very aware of both of those situations. On the first, one of the things that council has been really good about, and it's both good for the people and for the businesses here in Asheville, is protecting our water. Some years ago, Representative Tim Moffitt from South Buncombe tried to take away the city's water system and put it under a different control. Asheville has some of the best water in the world. We have an amazing system because both because of good planning in the past and because of our location. We're at the top of the watershed. We have some of the cleanest water in the world, and we have an ample supply most of the time, barring severe drought or when we've had dam breaks. I mean, you can't control everything. It's one of the reasons we're Beer City USA. Beer makers don't need to pre-treat water as much here because we have really good water to begin with. And data centers use enormous amounts of water. That's one of the environmental impacts. They use a lot of water for cooling, and when they release the water subsequent to that, it is toxic. They don't really clean it up well. So that's a big environmental issue. The other piece of it is the energy issue, the amount of energy they use. So putting a pause seems to me like a very good step. I happen to have done a lot of study recently about the whole data center issue. And I'm one of the believers that this thing's going to fall apart financially pretty quickly. I think we're going to see in the not distant future a lot of empty warehouse buildings that were being built for data centers that are no longer needed. There's a bubble going on. So that's my view. And how that'll play out with the local pause, I don't know. But I understand good environmental reasons. As for the Flock cameras, Mayor Mannheimer has tried to kind of finesse her vote because her opponent in the upcoming election, Kim Roney, was the only person on council who voted against the Flock cameras to begin with. But in Mannheimer's video recently, she said, "We on council voted for the Flock cameras, but I've changed my mind now." Well, we didn't. Six of them did, but the seventh one did not. I mean, but she's running for office, and I've been a politician. I understand. You do what you do. But yes, they're having second thoughts. It'd be interesting to see where they go with it, because part of it is Flock, the company, which apparently has released data to other organizations like ICE and so forth. And so there may be some push on some part of the pro-security people to use a different camera system. So it's still an issue whether there's going to be cameras tracking everybody in town. There are Flock cameras already in use by private businesses. You know, I think we're all aware that a lot of businesses have security cameras. And there is an argument made that it helps prevent crime, that it helps solve crimes. And we admit there's an argument there, but it's the tracking of license plates and knowing where everybody is all the time, which leads to a bigger issue, which I don't think the city can quite address. And that is the degree to which we are constantly tracked. One of the things that startled me when I read about it a year or two ago is if you sign up with some commercial, like a retailer, retail business, like a department store or something like that, if you're on their, if you've got their app on your phone, and say you go in there and you stand in front of the blue jeans and you are thinking about blue jeans and you're looking at the prices and they decide not to buy them and you go out to the parking lot, you may well get a text with a discount before you get to your car that tells you right now you can get 10% off the blue jeans on aisle. I mean, they're tracking us by our phones too.
So let me ask you about, how has the council's approach to citizen input waxed and waned over the years? Would you say the current council good at listening to citizen input, especially when it regards development issues?
Right. Yes, it waxes and wanes. The town was in many ways run by extremely pro-business people up until the late 90s, when Lenny Sitnick, who was an activist in the Chemtronics toxic gas issue, which some people here will certainly remember, there was a company in Swannanoa making BZ gas, which was a military toxic gas. She helped fight that and got enough awareness that she became mayor in 1999. Maybe it was 97, sometimes the dates. Anyway, late 90s, Lenny Sitnick really opened up city council meetings to public input. And there was a lot of meetings would suddenly became very long. Previous to her terms in office, decisions were made ahead of time. And then there was a brief meeting to formalize everything. But she opened it up. And so that tradition carried on quite a bit into the future. And even now, there's more opportunity for public comment, although it's restricted in time now, kind of sharply restricted. In fact, on the Flock camera issue, there were many more people at the meeting wanting to speak than were allowed to speak at that meeting. And that's caused considerable disgruntlement, which is one of the reasons that the council was going to vote about terminating the contract with Flock. And what's now happened under Mayor Manheimer, and partly due to COVID, is that public input was quite restricted during COVID and has not been restored. And I think that's intentional. Asheville used to have one of the largest numbers of citizen committees in the state. We in Durham, North Carolina, were not popular in Raleigh with the Republicans in Raleigh, because we had too much public input. I think we had 24 or 25 citizen committees that would meet around specific issues, the environment, the tree canopy, the water issues, the parks and recreation, many different committees. And those committee meetings were sharply curtailed during COVID for obvious reasons. Some of them went to Zoom type meetings, but it was kind of squashed. And with the Mayor Manheimer and then Vice Mayor Gwen Whistler, they came up with an idea to crush those down to 7 citizen committees, and then they were put on hiatus. Now the citizen committees, I don't think they got them down as low as 7, but the citizen committees are now on an as-needed basis. So they no longer have monthly meetings. So there's no longer that level of communication. And I think that has sort of squashed the public input.
Is there a push to get some of those committees revived and involved in the process?
I believe there is through some of the candidates running for office this year in the city council. It would be good to check their websites to see if they've made specifics, but there is certainly a citizen push to have more input again. I'm not sure to the degree to which it might be an organized effort right now.
You're listening to A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. And our guest today is Cecil Bothwell, an investigative reporter and biographer based in Asheville, and author of over 20 books. His latest book is Regarding Charlie, and Cecil will be speaking at Firestorm Books in West Asheville on Wednesday, September 2nd at 6 p.m. Okay, that's the Isley Brothers singing Fight the Power from the album The Essential Isley Brothers. Cecil, are there any plans or have there ever been any plans that you're aware of for inner city development that considers livable spaces that focus on building environments that promote social interaction, overall well-being, and so on? That includes accessible recreation areas, community engagement to enhance people's quality of life. We've been talking about business development, but are there any kind of developments, ideas that are focused in this other way?
There certainly are. And in fact, that touches on one of the big pushes that Park made over the years. Way back in the, around 2000 in a city plan, there was the idea, I think it was called the 2025 plan. There was a goal of having walkable parks within 15 minutes minimum walk between them all through the downtown area, so that wherever you were, you could walk that long or less to another park, another green space. And one of the places that was even identified back then, so this is 26 years ago, was the area in front of the Basilica, in front of the Civic Center. There is city-owned property there, which reporter John Boyle disparaged as the Pit of Despair, which is what it came to be called by many people. But it's a piece of city property that qualifies in terms of distance from other green spaces. There is Pritchard Park at the intersection of Patton and Haywood, but that's not really a park. It was a former post office and then a bus station, which has a tree or two, but it's not, it's paved. It's not a park-like area. So one of the fights that Park made over the years was to prevent commercial development in front of the Basilica there, and won that fight. A couple of different efforts were canceled, which are a big part of the book that I wrote. And then the city council voted to designate it as a park and paid a highly qualified, internationally known design company to design a park there. The city paid $260,000 for the design, and then COVID hit. And it's been backburnered since that point. But the plan exists, the land exists. It's the place where the Elder and Sage Community Garden has, they sort of squatted on the property because it was vacant. Mostly people from the Battery Park apartments there adjacent to it, and developed a beautiful garden there. Mm-hmm. And the design by the design company includes making that there would be a space for a community garden on a finally developed park there. Now that addresses the green space element of it. In terms of housing, there have been various plans advanced. Most permits for apartment complexes these days require a certain percentage of the apartments to be available at a rate that is affordable at 130% of the local poverty level, the local designated poverty level. So all of the big new apartments you see around downtown have 10% of the units that will be available, that are available at a reduced rate, usually for 10 years, which is, I guess, the best that the city could do in terms of negotiation. But at least they're more affordable for that length of time. Mm-hmm. Places like some of the Asheville Housing Authority complexes, which are the low-income housing places that were developed during what happened during the what urban renewal occurred during the 50s and 60s, have been upgraded with green spaces, with playgrounds, with much nicer units. Plus, they've moved toward mixed income in the housing authority, so that not everyone is on welfare. What they found was that often when they created housing complexes, they created ghettos. And so now you have people who've lived for generations, their families have lived for generations in subsidized housing. Whereas in housing places where they have mixed income, there's more incentive to move on up. So there are efforts in that regard.
The housing... we're just getting near the end of the show. I just wanted to insert, you mentioned about that plot of land that across from the Basilica, and in your book, you talk about in 2007 that the McKibben Hotel Group had a plan for a 10-story building occupying that property. What became of that?
Well, it was long fought over. Park did a lot of organizing around protests and around letters written, around petitions and so forth. Some different things occurred. One is that the McKibben Hotel chain, which has the Aloft and other properties downtown, was on the verge of building there. And two other hotel chains filed suit against McKibben and against the city because it had ducked around the bidding process. They had sort of accorded McKibben the property without going through proper channels. And McKibben didn't want to make the fight and finally backed out and bought what was the BB&T building down at the end of Pack Park and converted it to a hotel instead with whatever money he had at the time. There had been, previous to that, there had been a push for a parking deck that was going to wrap around the Battery Park apartments, claiming that we really had to have parking downtown. The parking deck issue, as I discuss in the book, was a series of bad mistakes on the part of the city. Probably the most laughable was they paid for a plan for the deck before they had the land secured. They then contracted for a company to manage a deck that they didn't have the land or the building. And they forgot to write into the management plan that you had to have a building first. So the city ended up paying a management company for a few years to manage a non-existent parking deck. There were a lot of mistakes made there, a lot of expensive mistakes made there. But the public opinion constantly swayed against it. And then various dips in the economy worked against it. COVID worked against that. But by the time COVID hit, the plan for the park had already been made. So I think the development plans were then shelved by that point.
So just got a few minutes left, but talk briefly about how your life has changed over the years as you've known Charlie Thomas and been involved in various political economic issues of the Asheville community. And secondly, is he still actively involved in Park?
Yes, he's active, but minimally so. He's older now, and other people have picked up the baton, so to speak. I'd say the biggest way that I was affected personally, in addition to being tuned in to issues, in addition to being spurred to organize the Rolling Thunder Down Home Democracy issue and event and meeting Jim Hightower and getting connected with national people there, was his urging me to write the book about Billy Graham. Because in the afterword to that book, I said I knew that people would think I was making a religious case against Billy, and I was not, that this was political. But just for the record, I do not believe in supernatural beings of any stripe. That was the only time I'd ever mentioned my belief or lack thereof anywhere in public. But when I ran for city council, some conservatives in town, led by Chris Peterson, a downtown property owner, ran postcards against me, warning that I was an atheist and that I was going to bring down Asheville and take it to hell. And and they didn't succeed. But then another fella tried to keep me from being sworn in because the North Carolina Constitution still says you have to believe in God to serve on council in government. But that doesn't apply because of the U.S. Constitution. There is no religious test for office. So when I was sworn in, I affirmed that I would uphold the Constitution of North Carolina and the United States. But Rachel Maddow picked up on that, the effort to keep me from being sworn in. And I got 15 minutes of fame out of that. I got invited all over the country. I've been in 25 cities, a dozen states, coast to coast, speaking about non-theism, about non-theism in government, about government policy. So I had my little fling for a couple of years. I spoke all over the place. I still get speaking engagements. And I never would have had reach. That's one of the reasons my Billy Graham book has sold well, is because of the notoriety they gave me by trying to keep me from being sworn in.
So tell us, how can people find out more about you and your work?
The easiest way would be to go to cecilbothwell.com. That's my name.com. You could also Google me or DuckDuckGo. I prefer that. They don't track you. And if you write to me at cecilbothwell@gmail.com, I answer emails that are reasonable. I'm happy to interact with people. I believe in community organizing. That's partly one of the things I've learned from knowing Charlie these years. I think it's really important. And one whole chapter in the book is his rules for organizing. Because one of the things I want the book to do is to tell people, you can do this. You don't need to be an elected official. You don't need to be a community so-called leader. You can organize with some friends and make things change.
Tell us kind of what you're going to be talking about at your appearance at Firestorm Books coming up.
I will be talking about the book, of course, and about Asheville history. And I think that Asheville has been an activist community in many ways, going way back. It's not that it's new in the last 25 years. It's part of a continuum. There have been other leaders and other successes over this time. In fact, one of the things that county commission member Brownie Newman said was he got wind of an email from the Department of Transportation, North Carolina DOT, an email that referred to those Asheville types. We were making problems about the I-26 connector.
That's like years ago, Senator Jesse Helms. I went to school in Chapel Hill. He talked about Chapel Hill in a similar vein back in the, I guess it was the 70s.
Yeah. And of course, there was that legislator from the Charlotte area who referred to Asheville as a cesspool of sin.
No wonder I'm attracted to Asheville, huh?
That's right. That's right. We still are.
Well, on that note, I want to thank Cecil Bothwell for being on the show today. If you want to know more about Cecil, you can check out his website, but also you can listen to him at Firestorm Books in West Asheville on Wednesday, September 2nd at 6 p.m. Cecil, thank you so much for being on the show, and all the best to you, and I hope you'll come back again.
Thank you very much, McNair. I've enjoyed this conversation.
You've been listening to A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. This is McNair Ezard. Thank you for joining us, and hopefully we'll see you next time on A Better World. And we're going out today with the Grateful Dead singing Ripple.
If my words did glow with the gold of sunshine, and my tunes were played on the harp unstrung, would you hear my voice come through the music? Would you hold it near as it were your own? It's a hand.